fate of a soccer stadium, the high cost of recycling, and putting power underground. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Miami voters will now decide if they want a soccer stadium and massive real estate development to replace a public golf course. While there's no public money, it would be built on public land. Miami Commissioner Ken Russell will join us. Then, some Broward County cities have seen the cost of their recycling programs double or more. At least one city has suspended collecting bottles and cans, while others have paid the price. Why the big jump in costs, and who ultimately pays for it? And are underground power lines really the solution to power outages in South Florida? Almost a year after Hurricane Irma, FPL has launched a pilot program burying more power lines. All that ahead with your phone calls and tweets on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Back in 2014, when David Beckham first came to South Florida announcing his intention of bringing a Major League Soccer team to town, he was confident there would be plenty of interest from top-notch players to take the field in Miami. But more than 4 years later, there's no field to take. There's no soccer stadium for Beckham's franchise, at least not yet. And now it's up to Miami voters if they want to turn a public golf course into a soccer stadium. But it's more than just a soccer stadium that'll be on the November ballot. It's a massive real estate development that includes offices, retail space, hotels. It would replace the Melrose Country Club, the only city-owned golf course in the city of Miami, just east of Miami International Airport. Voters in the city of Miami will be asked if the city should negotiate with David Beckham's ownership group for a no-bid lease on the land to build the soccer complex. It was a 3-2 vote by the Miami City Commission this week. Do you support leasing the land, turning the public golf course into a soccer stadium, an office complex, a hotel, and have several dozen acres worth of green space park? South Florida certainly has a history of bad sports stadium deals. How do you make sure the city is getting a good deal this time around? And beyond a professional soccer stadium, what's in it for you if you drive around that neighborhood, live in that neighborhood, work in that area? 800-743-WLRN. Phone lines open right now on the Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576. You can also join our conversation on Twitter. At WLRN is our handle. Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell is back with us here on WLRN. Commissioner, welcome back. Nice to have your time today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You were the swing vote. What brought you over to the yay category to send this to voters?
This was probably the most difficult vote I've ever had as a city commissioner, and I was a no from the start because the knee-jerk reaction, and if you ask anyone, should we ever develop green space, the answer is no. Should we ever do a no-bid deal, the answer should be no. When you really unpack this, and I started out as a no, I started getting tons of emails, both for and against this project, but really with specific concerns. People wanted to know what this was. And so I had to bring those concerns into a list of demands. And I said, if you meet these demands, it would be okay to bring this to the voters, but not before that.
And were all those demands met by the ownership group?
I actually never thought they would say yes to what we were asking for. But in the end, they did. And so for me, if we could unpack what those things are, yep. Does it make this okay? I don't know. I'm not an advocate for this. I'm not cheerleading for this. I'm not promoting it. I'm saying I believe it's safe to go to the voters. I believe the ballot language is clear enough for the voters to make an educated decision. And if they do say yes, it's not a bad deal for the city or the taxpayers or the green space.
We will unpack some of those items, but was there anything that you requested that you didn't get that you were able to compromise on and still get to yes on your vote?
No, I had about 6 points that I asked for from the First Tee program that operates there, a charity for kids, character building,
it's
and golf.
A golf charity program.
Green space, no net loss. We couldn't lose any of that. That no city funds are used in this, that this is not a subsidized project whatsoever. The contamination remediation, that we don't have any responsibilities there. And that if they were going to do a financial deal on the leased portion, that there would be a revenue share that the city would partake in. Mm-hmm. And finally, that they produce a living wage for everyone who works on that entire site.
Let's talk about each of those, beginning with the payment to the city. This was the point of contention from the get-go when the first details of this draft plan came about, where it was a flat fee that the ownership group, the developers, were offering the city of Miami to essentially lease the land for a few terms with some options that would be about 99 years ultimately.
Correct.
The new term sheet, which is essentially what you've agreed to, provides a percent of revenue. So if they're able to generate and they think they could get somewhere to the tune of almost $500 million in revenue from this development when it's all built out. The city would enrich itself with some of those dollars.
So, you know, this isn't about money to start. There were so many things that are more important than that. But if we get down to that, the stadium deals that have been done in the past were not financially fair to the city or the county. And I wanted to make sure that if we even consider this, not only does it not cost us money, that if they make money, we do as well. So a flat rate wasn't good enough. And it actually looked low. And to the perception of anyone looking at it for the 70-some acres that they would develop with a stadium and et cetera, $3.5 million a year just doesn't seem like a reasonable amount, even though... Yeah.
That was the first flat fee that was proposed, and George Perez of the Related Group sent an email to media decrying how low that rate would be, given that they expected to generate $450 million of revenue a year when it's fully built out.
And in a sense, he's right, but the $400 million is revenue generated on-site even by third-party tenants and such, so that doesn't necessarily mean that the Beckham Group would be enriched by that. So that's taxable money, and that does benefit us indirectly. But really, for me, what was important was in the lease. So if they have success, the city has success. 10 years down the road, it doesn't look inequitable.
Yeah, and that number is 5% of
rent.
Correct. Right,
yeah, and so if they participate in a revenue share with one of their tenants, like let's say the Adidas store is there,
yep,
and every shoe enriches them, then it enriches the city as well. The only thing we don't have access to is if they have a third-party tenant who is a restaurant, and they're not making money from the restaurant.
Understood. 5%, and would you get 5% of ticket sales, for instance, for the soccer stadium?
So right now, and one of the concessions they made was we get 5% of their rent with the stadium company. So I said any of their affiliates, so that they couldn't create a shadow company or a barrier, a veil that would keep us from getting to those revenues. We'll absolutely be looking at ticket share. And granted, this is a floor. The true negotiation is if the voters say yes to this concept, then the management has the ability to really dig in and make a proper lease contract. This was only my requirements to even get to the table.
The management, meaning the management.
The city management.
The city management. So, right, because what voters are voting on is this is the bare minimum of any kind of lease deal.
The basics. And truly, I mean, we didn't vote to approve the project. We voted to put this to the voters to get their permission to waive our bidding process.
Right.
That's really key that voters understand that. And why would we do that?
Yeah. Speaking with Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell about the City Commission vote 3-2 this week to put a ballot referendum to Miami City voters this fall to give the city essentially the okay for a no-bid lease negotiation with David Beckham's soccer development team. Your phone calls, 800-743-9576. They're lining up right now, Commissioner, and we'll get to them here in a second. A couple other financial points that I do want to draw out here before we do talk about some of what you call the bigger issues, the green space issue and some others. This lease deal would call for, in addition, payment to the city of $20 million over 30 years after a park is delivered to the city. What does that mean, a park is delivered to the city?
So there's about 130 acres there. They're looking at in 70, about 70 of it would be for the soccer stadium and their commercial side development. But the other 58 acres, almost 60 acres, would become the city's largest open space green park with free access. And so people recognize that $20 million over 30 years is not enough to build that park. So it was important for me that they memorialize in writing in this term sheet, which is now part of the record, mm-hmm. so they're held to it, that they deliver a park before that $20 million even comes into play. Now, so that gives us a green space park. If we want to go beyond that as a city and, you know, make it a very active park with different amenities, or we want to take that $20 million annuity over to other places and use it for green space, we can. But we will get a park out of this.
So by getting a park in green space, just to be specific, I mean, you're going to get, it will be, you will have grass there, the trees will be planted, the playground equipment will be there.
First of all, it'll be fully remediated of any contamination, because what's there right now under the country club is completely contaminated site.
Yeah. And we'll dig down to that issue as well. But a deliverable park is a park that people can walk on and use. It's not just simply open space that you can then fill in with vegetation and shelters and other things.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct.
And the $20 million over 30 years, $600,000 a year over 3 decades. That's money that goes to the general fund or money that specifically goes to the Parks Department?
It'll go to the general fund, but it'll be earmarked for parks and green space. Its intention will be to be used on site, because I believe once they hand that park back to us, the maintenance alone will probably eat that up.
800-743-9576. Your thoughts, your comments about the possibility of a soccer stadium where a public golf course is now in the city of Miami, just east of Miami International Airport. Some calls here for Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell. Let's begin in Miami, where Daniel is online too. Daniel, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm a proponent for the new soccer stadium. I'm an accountant myself, and I've been reading into it and just learned a lot on your comments. And truly, I believe it's a no-brainer. The revenue that it will generate to the city through a number of different income streams far outweighs what the public golf course is generating. In addition, people, as you said, we never want to give up green space, but let's not forget that the golf course is not an open park where you can go with your family and have a picnic. It's a golf course. So unless you play golf or you're paying to be there, it's what I wouldn't consider an open park space. So in addition into generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue that's taxable to the city, it will create a true open green space park for us. And anybody can go and enjoy it. And for those reasons and many others, I'm a proponent for it, and I hope that the voters vote accordingly.
Daniel, thank you for your thoughts. Commissioner Russell.
He's right in that currently, even though it is green space, it is not openly accessible.
Yeah, it's space that's green right
now. It is a commercial country club.
Right.
You pay to play golf. And so if you are a golf advocate, for sure you would be against this. That's where we get into the difficult decision of, is this open green space? Yes, it is zoned as park. And what goes there, if their commercial side development removes any part of green space, if they build concrete, I need it replicated. So we have a no net loss.
Somewhere in the city.
Yes, but if you talk soccer versus golf and passive green space versus golf, that's where the fights start happening, even within the green space advocates. One other thing they're adding for us is 12 open soccer fields for public use. And if you have a kid that plays soccer in the city, you know that we don't have enough space where coaches, freelance coaches are teaching kids how to play soccer. And so this wouldn't be their academy. This would be an open public. And so that's in addition to the 58 acres.
800-743-9576. Continuing our conversation with Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell about the vote to allow city voters in Miami to decide whether or not the city commission should negotiate a no-bid lease for a development of the Melrose Country Club golf course just east of Miami International Airport to become the site of a Major League Soccer stadium, office space, hotel, retail, restaurants, and green space as well. Let's go to Oscar in the city of Miami on line 3. Oscar, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
Yes, sir. I have a question to the commissioner. Of course, to do this, all this project, they have to change the zoning of the land.
Correct.
All right? They have to put it the commercial zoning for the land. And they are paying $4.5 million, something like that, rental for 99 years. That reflects less than $15 a foot of the land. And let me tell you, it's 99 lease, and really, you are purchased the land. Do you have, Commissioner, an idea what is the value, the market value of the 79 acres of land, prime land, rezoned as commercial?
Gotcha.
Do you have an idea?
Oscar, I know there was a few appraisals that the commission essentially commissioned to make the decision this week, and there was some price put on the overall land of the Melrose, the 131 acres.
Yes, and we were able to parse that out to Oscar's exact question about the 70 acres, and that's where they came back to that number. Keeping in mind,
which was
that it's at that $3.5 million a year level
over 99 years.
Yes, if
right.
you were to rent it over 99 years, it doesn't. You know, what you're taking into account here is also that it's contaminated land and there are height limitations with regard to FAA next to the airport.
Right.
But once they do the remediation, we will then reassess. And I believe the picture then will be completely different, and we'll have the right and ability to do that once the remediation is complete.
So just so we can put a button on this for Oscar and others, $3.5 million is, again, the base amount of rent, essentially, that you would collect from the Beckham Group if they're successful in all this. Over the course of 99 years, that's roughly $350 million. That's for that 70-some-odd acre portion that would be developed here.
Plus all of the other concessions that they were willing to do, 5% of revenue share and 1% of any capital transactions that happen on site.
Let's talk about the remediation, because that could be a significant cost if the voters approve it and if there's a successful negotiation with the city commission. It is contaminated. We know this. All the appraisals that came in for the city commission to consider, all of them mention the fact that it's contaminated land, but they did not do any environmental assessment of the level of contamination. Jorge Mas, who has been the financier in kind of the local face of the David Beckham Group, has pledged, I want to say, $35 million or so or more that they expect to pay for the remediation. Is there any financial risk to the city of Miami, under your understanding, regarding the cleanup that would be necessary for the Melrose Golf Course for this development to take place?
Absolutely not. And if there is, we don't go forward. Either ironically or fittingly, I am sort of the green space commissioner who knows about contamination, because before I became a commissioner a couple of years ago, I was just a surfboard salesman living in front of a contaminated park who got in a fight with the city about it. This is the exact same contaminated ash that was in Merry Christmas Park, yep, by my house. Mm-hmm. But on obviously a much larger scale. The historical documents say that the mounds of the golf course were built from bringing in the ash fill. So it's been remediated since then, but only for a golf course use. Park use and obviously their commercial use will be very expensive. And I don't care if it's $50 million or $100 million, the city cannot be responsible for a dime of that.
So if the voters approve of this no-bid negotiation and you go back and sit down with the Beckham Group and Jorge Mas of MasTec, your position as a city commissioner would be, it doesn't matter how much that remediation, we're not going to cap. You can't come to us with a cap that you're only willing to spend X, and the city would be on the hook for over that amount.
Correct. And so pinning him down on that was very difficult, because they said, well, we don't really know what it is.
Right.
I said, well, that's your problem. If it gets to your budget, obviously has a limit. And if you can't exceed that, you got to walk away, because you're not going to come back to us to remediate a site that already is sufficiently remediated for its current purpose. And I'm perfectly fine if the voters choose to keep it as a golf course. It's fine.
Well, if the voters choose to keep it as a golf course, then you don't have that negotiation after November, certainly. But if you do, your position that I'm hearing now is the remediation is all on the development group. There is no bit whatsoever that that you're willing to consider the city pick up the tab for.
Correct. Now, there are incentives out there and available for environmental cleanups, and those are at the state and federal level. If they want to apply for those, that's fine with me. Mm-hmm. If the city as the landlord needs to help fill out the paperwork, that's fine with me. But if a matching is needed from the city as the landlord, that is not fine.
Not even the matching money.
They would have to come up with anything.
Gotcha. 800-743-9576. Speaking with the Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell, he was the swing vote approving a ballot referendum for City of Miami voters this fall on whether or not the city moves forward with negotiations over a proposed Major League Soccer stadium just east of Miami International Airport. Lots of talk about additional traffic, local property values, neighborhood impact. David is in Miami on line one. David, you've been patient. Go ahead. You're speaking with the commissioner now.
Yes, I'd be interested to know how this will improve the access to and from the airport.
So they have a lot yet to go with regard to traffic studies. That certainly has been insufficient. And some would say that the vote that we took didn't need that level of scrutiny, because the lease has yet to be, you know, all we were asking is to the voters, we're voting whether the voters want us to even consider this. All the traffic studies they will have to do need to come. Mm-hmm. And that's crucial, because traffic in that area is bad.
Yeah.
Now, there is a chance, because they're looking at expanding the entrances here and do the stacking on site.
What does that mean, stacking?
So where cars queue up on the road, and this is on Lejeune and Douglas, basically, okay, where the main entrances would be.
Stacking is a term for what we'd call a traffic jam?
Yes.
Okay.
we don't want these projects to add to our problems. Potentially, though, the logistics here are that this site, in their mind, could be suitable for public transit, because it's right across the road from the MIC, which has Tri-Rail, it has Metro Rail,
yeah.
it has bus, it has everything there.
The MIC is the building just off of Miami International Airport that has the car rental counters and, the as you mentioned,
yes,
Tri-Rail's there.
The Intermodal Center.
Intermodal yeah. Center, yeah.
And they would be responsible for any financial connection, any logistic connections to get people to and from that to reduce car traffic. But they've got a lot of work in that regard to go.
A couple of social media comments here, Commissioner. One from Raul, who sent us a tweet at WLRN. I'm opposed to the deal. It is one of the best open spaces still left in Miami, and to turn it into another tourist monstrosity would be a slap in the face to every resident of the city. Peter sent us this note. I oppose leasing the Melrose Park, it's Melrose Golf Course, using a no-bid deal under the proposed terms. Elected officials should show respect for taxpayer-owned public parks. We've attacked this issue and discussed this issue of golf course and park and green space, but what about this issue of the no-bid deal? That was another piece in your opening comments where you said you initially were a no because this was a no-bid deal. You weren't going to put it out for others to make you perhaps better offers than what this one is.
And our charter actually requires us to do a bidding process for proposals. The only way that is ever waived is through a referendum with the voters. If the voters believe that this is the right project and this is the right partner, they can waive that ability. And we've done that before on several projects.
So why go forward with that here as opposed to pushing for a bidded project?
Right. So you use bidding for a couple reasons. One is if you don't know what you want to do with the land and you do a request for proposals. Mm-hmm. And then everything comes in that might be commercial or green space or active or not. And then the other reason is to get the best price. You want people to fight over what their offer is. And so in this particular case, the mayor has a vision, and the commission, through public hearings back in 2014, passed a resolution to bring Major League Soccer to Miami.
Right.
And that was even before I was there.
But after David Beckham was here in 2014.
Correct,
sure.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the city was partaking in this search with them on finding the right location. And the mayor believes that this is the right location. And so this came to the commission after the mayor and the Beckham group had put together this concept. So the proposal is what it is. It's not that we're looking for what we should or could do with the land. It's a yes or no to the public. Yeah. Do you want us to do this or not?
So you're not looking to redevelop Melrose Country Club
we were not.
Into something else. It was this particular group came with this particular project, and that's why, in your mind, it justified the potential of a no-bid
Well,
offer.
If it at least taking it to the voters and letting them decide, it doesn't justify it to me whether or not, and so then the other part of the bidding is, what about getting the best financial deal?
Right.
And that's where I had a problem, and I was a no on just the flat.
A couple of more phone calls here, Commissioner. Let's squeeze in from Broward County, hearing from McKenzie and Davey. Go ahead, McKenzie. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm in Davey, but I am a resident of Miami-Dade County.
Gotcha.
A quick question. I'm thinking about the American Airlines Arena and the promise of a park, I believe, in Parcel B, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, yep.
And so my concern is, what parameters or what guarantees do residents of the city of Miami and Miami-Dade County have that there would be a park built at this particular site?
Great point. Long memory there for McKenzie about a previous stadium deals and previous promises for green space next to them. That was one of the promises with the AAA. Has not come to fruition. So what guarantees could you give McKenzie?
So we should learn from the past. And this issue with what I like to call Dan Paul Park, which is Parcel B, it's taken forever. But the county commissioner there, Audrey Edmondson, is absolutely dedicated. That's a county piece of land.
That's
and
right.
So obviously I don't have direct influence on that, but I'm supporting her in making sure that becomes the park it was always promised to be, whether through American Airlines Arena or through the county or whatever we
but
need
it hasn't
to do.
Happened yet, and we've gotten two or three NBA championships in the meantime.
Actually, I have to give the county commissioner a lot of credit. If you go out there now, the Baywalk is complete at Parcel B, and there is green space. Granted, it's in the wrong spot. The concrete area is closest to the water, and the park
yeah.
space is further back.
So what's the lesson learned for this proposal?
Enforcement. Enforcement of your contracts, enforcement of your agreements. And if that wasn't done back then, we need to have the teeth in this that it's done here.
I also want to talk about economics when it comes to workers and residents. There is a provision in the term sheet that requires the developers to pay a living wage of at least $15 an hour for covered employees without health insurance. What's a covered employee? Who's a covered employee under this?
Right. So this wasn't even in the discussion to start with. And I have to be honest, of the hundreds of emails I was receiving for and against this, nobody was really talking about the wage of the employees on site. But we have a crisis of income equality in the city. We have to bring down the cost of housing and we have to bring up what people make. And wherever the city, even though we can't mandate a living wage, if this is a project, the biggest project ever on city land, we should be able to mandate that they do that or at least come to a contractual agreement. And so my requirement was $15 an hour for everyone that works on site.
Regardless of who the employer is.
Correct. And that's where it was a sticking point. Right. And it became a philosophical debate. And that's where, right to the last minute, I was a no and they were pulling their hair out. Because it wasn't that they were being cheap and not wanting to pay 15. They didn't believe that their tenants, the people that rent from them, they could force it.
Right. So this means $15, a minimum of 15 without health insurance for construction workers, but ultimately then for janitors in the office.
Groundskeepers, janitors, ticket takers, parking attendants.
Bartenders, restaurant workers.
Yes. And so in the end, they did agree. Now, on the tenants that they can't, you know, they have to woo in and they can't control. They decided finally to agree to mandate, but what I gave them some relaxed on there is that they could step up from an $11 start to 15 over 4 years, so they could rent it out, and then those would have to step up as
way
well.
Way out in the weeds, but it's important because it's hospitality-dominated economy here. Is this a tipped wage?
So, you know, a lot of tipped workers actually don't want to be under a minimum wage, and so there will be flexibility in that, I believe, because I don't want to hurt. I want to help the worker.
Squeeze in a couple more calls here. Kendall, Shannon, you are on the radio. Go ahead, Shannon.
Oh, you mean Sharon?
Sharon. I'm sorry, Sharon. Yes, it says that right in front. I know I need a new prescription for my eyeglasses,
now
I've proved it.
It's okay. Thanks for speaking with me. I have a curious question. David Beckham, soccer, love it. I know he's trying. Why doesn't he think of an association with Marlins Park? I mean, it's nearly empty, and I know the county, or I think the county, has some sort of association with Marlins Park, which apparently is empty most of the year, and I think it would be wonderful. It's all there for both soccer and baseball.
Sharon, we appreciate the thoughts, and I think Marlins Park came up initially as the Beckham Group was looking at a lot of different locations. Commissioner, can you shed some light on that?
That's a great question, Sharon, and it's one of the first ones I asked. So they, the group we're doing the lease potential lease deal with is the holder of the MLS franchise, Major League Soccer, and they have their own requirements that they have to fall under. Now, that doesn't cause emergencies for us, but one of them is that they have to have their own freestanding stadium for soccer use only, and that precluded the Marlins.
One quick final question from Kendall as well. Albert, go ahead, Albert. You're on the radio.
Hey, listen, I'm just very happy to hear the commissioner speak as if the city of Miami had decided to have some self-respect. I mean, what we've heard over the years is so much just throwing themselves at the developers, and I just appreciate that you're acting, Dennis, as if, you know, the city meant something, that we're worth something, and you're trying to drive a hard bargain. The thing I wanted to point out that maybe folks weren't thinking of is that the Melrose Golf Course ends up being kind of like a front yard to the city to folks who fly in. In other words, you see all this green space, and it's, you know, it may not be a completely accurate impression, but it looks like there's an awful lot of trees in Miami when you fly in, you know, and it's kind of nice to pick folks up at the airport and drive past and see all that. Is there any sense of being able to keep that view corridor?
So I've seen the renderings that they've proposed, and they're trying to maximize green space throughout the whole project. Almost, though, to their detriment, though, because if they start trying to classify certain areas of retail development as green space because they've put some trees in it, that does not get them out of the no net loss park requirement that I have.
Yeah. Do you want to share what your vote will be like in November at the ballot? Will you vote for this referendum or not?
I actually...
You voted to put it on the ballot. Now, will you vote for it?
Wow. You know, I had never even thought of it from that perspective. I'm fighting for the residents to have their voice and ability and clarity to make a good decision on this. I'll reserve my decision on
all
that
right,
for later.
So noted. Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell with us here on the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time, Commissioner. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
We got plenty more to come, including the higher cost of recycling in Broward County. That's next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. The cost of recycling bottles, cans, paper, cardboard in some Broward County cities has skyrocketed, and at least one city isn't paying it. Deerfield Beach has suspended its curbside recycling program in the face of seeing the cost of collection double. The price hike came this month when previous contracts expired. Those deals were with a company named Sun Bergeron, but part of that company is now owned by Waste Management, which the city is blamed for rising prices. More than a dozen other cities in Broward County have signed new contracts to have the recyclables still picked up. So, is your recycling being picked up? How much could it cost you in your city? And how does the competition for your used bottles and paper drive prices? That's up next here on the Roundup, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I want to first welcome back to the Roundup Dan Christensen, editor and founder of the online publication Florida Bulldog. Great. Always to have you back here, Dan. Explain, first of all, quickly, if you can, how recycling collection works in Broward County.
Well, it works different in different cities sometimes, but basically it's for all the Sun Bergeron cities, it's what's called single stream recycling, meaning that you have one cart for your garbage and regular trash, and then you have recycling where paper, plastic, that sort of thing goes in.
Sun Bergeron is one of the players, or had been one of the players. Who are the companies that work with these municipalities?
Well, Sun Bergeron was the single stream recycler for, I think it was 17 cities within the county, including Fort Lauderdale. And they have sort of been pushed out now because Waste Management bought a company that owned half of that joint venture, half of the Sun Bergeron joint venture. And they would not renew the contracts under the terms that had been previously enunciated right. In a private way. I'll get into that.
And we'll talk about that. What happened with the expiration? What happened this month, really, with some of these contracts for these communities?
Well, most of the cities have, Coral Springs sort of led the way. They came up with a deal with Waste Management regarding this. And I think it's 14 or 15 of the other cities piggybacked on it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all, and they continue to have their recycling done as before, although there are questions about how much of it's going to end up in the landfill.
Yeah.
But two cities, Deerfield and Sunrise, both decided not to go this much more expensive route, because all the cities that did do it, their numbers, their costs doubled from approximately 50 to approximately 100.
As it turns out, the mayor of Sunrise is across the table from
yes.
you and with us right here. Michael Ryan, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to see you, Your Honor. So what are the price hikes that you considered and you rejected?
As Dan said, the price hike was substantial. We were essentially going to go from about $50 a ton to $100 a ton. And for our city, that would have been maybe $300,000 extra for taxpayers. But it wasn't just that hike. There were also provisions in these contracts that would allow the hauler to make a decision that there was too much contamination. And this is a sub-issue that is so important to the recycling discussion.
So for those of us who aren't knee-deep in recycling, what does contamination mean?
So recyclables are a commodity, right? Paper, glass, whatever. And we've done a really good job of encouraging people to put things in the bin. But sometimes they put too much. They put the pizza boxes in, or they accumulate their recycles in plastic bags and they put those in the bin. And what happens is these haulers don't separate it. This idea that once it's in the bin, somebody will pick through it and find the good stuff is not how it happens. And then when you add the international collapse, where the levels of contamination that were acceptable, you just see all of a sudden
right.
that the haulers would be in charge of this. So the hard part for us was, what is the back end? If they decide that there's too much contamination, our prices go up higher or it ends up in the landfill. So for us, recycles are either for reuse or waste to energy. We made the decision in the interim to make sure that all of it's going to waste to energy. That is a way of handling recycling. It's not the public policy that we all want, and we need to do something about it. But in the interim, that's how we see it.
Waste to energy means that the what had been sent to the recycling factory, essentially, is now sent to an incinerator.
Correct. It's, and it converts to electricity.
Right, right. And then they use that to generate electricity.
Right, because the idea of going to the landfill was just unacceptable from a public policy standpoint.
One of your fellow Broward municipal mayors, also along with us, Weston Mayor Daniel Sturmer. Mayor Sturmer, welcome back to WLR. Nice to see you again, too. You were not party to any of this. Weston had its own separate recyclable contract. Does that remain in force? And what are the terms of that others could learn from?
It remains in force, but currently we actually have an RFP on the street because our current hauling contract, which is solid waste and recyclables, expires next year. So we currently are out on the streets soliciting bids and are waiting to see what the responses are. There are times where you want to be ahead of the curve, and there are times where being at the back end of the curve is okay. So yeah, in some respects, we're watching what Coral Springs, Deerfield, Sunrise, and others are doing.
Does it worry you, though, because some of these cities did put out requests for proposal to try to avoid the price hikes that Dan Christensen has reported on, that your fellow mayor in Sunrise, Mayor Ryan, has experienced, and they got nothing back. There were no other companies out there.
We are really concerned. The issue becomes there's a pricing issue. There's a where is it going issue, but there also is who's watching the industry, which is allowing these prices conceivably to potentially be artificially inflated because they're driving competition out of the market. So there are a host of issues, whether it is haulers, whether it is where is it going. The question is, what's been the government oversight to date?
And I want to talk about that, but it starts, right, and I think your critique starts with pricing and pricing power here. And Mayor Ryan, the proposed new per ton fee that you mentioned, about $100, I think it was $96, not that we were going to quibble over that much, but essentially a doubling of what it would cost. Now, there is a value of what Sunrise residents recycled. So there's a value of those bottles and cans that folks would take in, and that value would then be taken off of what the recycling fee is. So the cost to the city is actually not $100 per ton.
Actually, the challenge you have is still with contamination and the ability to deliver these commodities to reuse. When this happened earlier in the year, when the alarm bells went off, when Coral Springs got no bids in response, all of us who thought we were going to be able to renew our contracts, we had another 5 years to solve this problem.
Right.
And there were plans in place to begin doing that. It was at that second that we realized that we were in a fully engulfed fire at this point. And we had to, and it wasn't until Dan Christensen's coverage of this and the real root causes allowed us to understand how complex it was. So the idea that they might be able to get a credit back assumes that the haulers don't have their own interest because they can't deliver the product, the commodity, elsewhere for reuse.
So I'm trying to just really understand the price versus the contamination challenge that these cities, frankly, and their taxpayers have. We invited a representative from Waste Management to appear on the program. The company declined the invitation. I did speak with their communications director, though, to understand and to hear more from their point of view. And they talked about this pricing mechanism that essentially has the value of the recyclable materials had been a source of revenue for your communities. When you were able to get it picked up at $50 a ton and you could sell it for $60 a ton, you made money. It didn't cost anything. And now, because the market has changed for various contamination reasons and others, it is now turning into a service which comes with a cost.
I think that's exactly right. You have all sorts of factors. China's role in not taking paper. The low oil prices have caused recycling of plastics to change its dynamic. And this is why the cities that are working together now are saying to themselves, we're going to have to be in control of the recycling. We're going to have to be an incubator for future reuse. We're going to have to figure out how to handle this ourselves. And we can't be subject to the vagaries of the market. And frankly, the consolidation impact that caught us all broadsided.
800-743-9576, speaking with two mayors from Broward County Municipality, Sunrise Mayor Michael Ryan, that was just him. Weston Mayor Daniel Sturmer is along with us, as well as Dan Christensen, editor and founder of the online publication Florida Bulldog, talking about the higher cost of recycling in Broward County. Do not put your pizza boxes in your recycling bins, right, Mayor Sturmer?
Tom, but let me say this. Since the devolvement of the Resource Recovery Board, there has been a unified consolidated effort on behalf of the cities and Broward County to say, what are we going to do about recycling?
Yep.
It's not like we didn't see this issue years ago. There's been an ongoing conversation. The issue was planning. And to all of a sudden, as the mayor said, we went from what was supposed to be a far-off fire to all of a sudden it jumped the line and it was here. That's what's created the issue today.
So, Dan, walk us through that, because this there's some real complexities of corporate takeover and acquisitions here, and letters of opinion, not even letters of opinion, just letters from the Attorney General's office versus the actual contractual obligations that Waste Management says that it agreed to.
Yeah. Back in 2015, the state of Florida, the Attorney General's office, and the federal government did an antitrust investigation of Waste Management's proposed, at the time, acquisition of a company called SWS, which also owned Sun Recycling, which in turn owned half of the Sun Bergeron joint venture. They did their investigation, and at the end of that, they issued a letter that was sent only to the attorneys for Waste Management and Sun, which was
the other company involved.
Waste Management again. And in that letter, they spelled out certain understandings that they had. They used the words agreements and understandings, I believe, were the two words they used. Anyway, in there was one thing that's most important for the cities. There was an understanding or agreement made by Waste Management and SWS that the cities would be allowed to, you know, renew their contracts now, this year, for another 5 years at the same terms, prices, and conditions. The Attorney General's office, however, never notified the cities that they had had this letter. They kept it secret. And I got it through a screw-up, frankly, at the Broward Courthouse, the clerk's office. I published it, and sort of it went like wildfire through the city.
So, Mayor Sturmer, Mayor Ryan, did you know that this letter existed?
None of us did until Dan published it.
It was jaw-dropping.
Jaw-dropping. So what would have been different had you known this letter existed, that there were understandings or agreements? And we'll talk about the legalese about that in a moment here. But if there was this understanding that you would still have another 5-year deal on your lower priced recyclable collection.
Well, up front, right away, we would have, since we were already in planning, what are we going to do in 2023? We would have done everything we could to confirm that understanding and begin that process of executing on the renewal. And since we didn't know about the letter, when we thought we could just invoke, and, you know, Coral Springs went out to try to get a bid and nobody came back, and we were told they're not going to renew it at the same terms, that left us almost no time. Mayor Sturmer and I raised the alarm countywide. There was an overwhelming fear from all the cities about this. And our efforts to try to get the company and the Attorney General to validate that agreement have failed.
So when I spoke with Waste Management on the record but off the air, they had said that this letter, these understandings, were not part of a kind of codified contract. It was not, you know, they had subcontracts that were set that that made those kinds of understandings null. And the Attorney General and the Department of Justice agreed to this merger without condition.
And Tom, that's the interesting point, because I recently sent a letter to the Attorney General asking her to come down here to explain that letter. And the response we got back was, you don't understand the letter, first of all. And secondly, if there's a problem, we'd like to talk to your staff today so you can explain to us the problem. While we may have closed our investigation of the merger, if there today is a competitive competition monopolistic issue in the marketplace, we'll look at it today. Wait a second. As Mayor Ryan said and Dan found, we didn't know about this original letter. It uses words that have significant legal meaning. Mike and I are both lawyers, and we've got significant city lawyers that look at this as well. You know what? To not have that memo, which would be a closeout memo, and I'm a former assistant attorney general for the state of Florida. I didn't work in the antitrust division. I worked in the consumer protection division, which is what Mike and I are doing and what Dan's helping do. We're seeking clarification. How does the government, whose role is to protect the community, do this and not tell the community what they did with those understandings?
Dan?
One other thing about this, the purpose of the letter, and when you read it, it is very clear. this letter was written. It was not codified. It wasn't made part of a legal agreement that everybody signed. But it was the Attorney General's understanding of the what they had been told by Waste Management. And it was on that basis that the Attorney General's office decided not to intervene and oppose the merger here. So it was,
and had to put conditions on it.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was an effective action. But why did they not tell the cities about this? Mm. Why did it take a fluke, frankly, for the cities to find out about it?
Mayor Sturmer.
And the interesting question is, those Sun Bergeron cities got letters, and the question became, it then provided a subcontract. Were the prices included in that subcontract that the cities were sent to? My understanding, it was redacted. And if the same documents were given to the Attorney General as part of their review, the letter said, same terms and conditions, look at the subcontract where they reserved the price, the right to raise the price. If that price was redacted, what did the Attorney General's office review?
And it's really important to understand, this was a very significant issue. This isn't a post-it that was put on some document that we need to talk about. It was critical because the cities were very concerned about the consolidation in the industry. People were raising alarm bells.
Yeah.
And it would have been natural for the folks in antitrust to say, how are we going to protect the consumers?
We got
to
leave it there. Sunrise Mayor Michael Ryan, Weston Mayor Daniel Sturmer, great to have your honors with us here on the Florida Roundup. Dan Christensen, always nice to have you as well.
Continues.
Dan Christensen, the editor and founder of the Florida Bulldog. We got lots more as the Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening to WLRN. Odds are your home lost power during Hurricane Irma. Over 90% of FPL customers lost electricity because of the storm's winds. Irma blew down trees and branches, palm fronds, sending all of them into overhead power lines, snapping them, sending South Florida into dark for days. So what you heard afterward, though, were a lot of calls to put power lines underground. But is burying power lines the solution to keeping the lights on in South Florida? It was the subject of a two-part report this week here on WLRN from Katie Swatowski, our reporter who covers Broward County, and Alexander Gonzalez, a WLRN producer. Katie, Alex, how about it? Are underground power lines the solution here, Katie?
They are and they aren't. I think that the list of pros is really important. They are more reliable for everyday service. But I think it's important to know that if you look long term, there's a lot of cons to start thinking about that we really haven't been thinking about.
What are some of those cons, Alex?
Well, primarily water, right? So if a hurricane comes and brings a lot of flooding and rain and water gets into those wires, as we pointed out, electricity and water don't mix.
Yeah.
And so that's going to cause a lot of issues for you.
What about the cost problem of putting those power lines underwater?
Yeah, they're incredibly expensive. So FPL says that it can cost a neighborhood between $500,000 per mile to more than $4 million per mile. So if a neighborhood's going to be thinking about this, you really should be sure that this is the investment you want.
Who pays for that?
So it is the residents in your FPL bill every month and through special tax assessments up front. So there are certain neighborhoods in Broward County that are going to be paying special taxes on this for the next 30 years.
Hmm. And how do you judge the success or failure of that kind of investment? Whether or not the lights stay on the next storm?
Whether or not the lights stay on after the next hurricane. It's interesting. Sea level rise might beat neighborhoods to it by the time they can actually install and pay for these underground lines.
If you could quickly give us a tutorial, Alex, about what does entail when you put a power line underground?
So you have to first hire a contractor, and then that contractor comes and basically is going to dig a trench, sort of, if you can imagine a trench,
yep.
It goes under, and then a PVC pipe goes in there, and then that's inside that PVC pipe is what's going to protect your wires. It's, it's also called like conduit, so that's sort of the idea. But FPL is actually experimenting with a newer technology that's hopefully going to be waterproof and might mitigate some of those cons.
Subaqueous.
A new term we need to learn in South Florida electricity and power. What about some of these pilot programs that you reported on with FPL?
So FPL just started in June. The idea is over the next 3 years, they're going to look at 10 neighborhoods across the state, most of which will be in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And right now they've started with three, and they're going door to door to ask neighbors if they can underground and get the permissions to underground more wires in their neighborhood as a whole.
And who pays for that?
The residents.
The residents. So they're asking to, so FPL is asking to put the power line underground at their expense. At the residents' expense. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, real quick, in our final moments, what's next for that pilot project?
So, they're just going door to door. They're starting to get permission from people now. And the idea is, once they get permissions and people agree, you know, hey, we're going to end up paying a little bit more for electricity each month. But the idea is to increase the network, so to speak.
And we want to hear from you. Help us figure out where these lines are going. If you've received a letter, you know, there's a form online that you can fill out.
Yep. Go look at WLRN.org if you've gotten the phone call or the knock on the door about underground power lines. Katie Swietalski and Alexander Gonzalez, thanks for sharing your reporting with us here on LRN. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Thank
Tom.
You.
That'll do it for the roundup this week. Our program is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. News director, Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. And our technical supervisor is Jason Zavka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thank you for tweeting and calling. And, of course, thank you for listening and supporting WLRN.